If you ask the average Orthodox Jew to define the mitzvah of Sfiras Omer, I think you'll get a lot of creative answers. Sfiras Omer, yeah, that has to do with Rabbi Kiva's students dying or something, something with the Beis Hamikdash or Tisha B'Av or something, we mourn, we don't fast, something about the Omer or something. And I have a sense that if you'd ask this question, what is the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer? Again, I think you'll get a lot of creative answers. However, if you look in the Sefer Chinuch, Mitzvah Shin Vav, Sefer Chinuch is very clear that the actual mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer has nothing to do with any of the above. Sefer Chinuch says, Pshat Mitzvah is really quite simple. The entire reason Hashem created the world, the reason Hashem freed the Klal Yisrael, was for them to be Makabel Torah. And the Yetzias Mitzrayim, leaving Egypt, was really just the entrance way. That was just the first step towards the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal was for the Jewish nation to be at the base of Har Sinai, being Makabel Torah. The reason we count Sfiras HaOmer is because we're counting down the days. We count down from the time we left Mitzrayim up until that great day. We count the 49 days, waiting in anxious anticipation. The only reason it's pushed to the day after and not the 15th is because the 15th of Nisan is segregated specifically to celebrate the Yetzias Mitzrayim. The day after, which was when the Korban Omer was brought, was the first day of the counting. We count 49 days in anxious anticipation of when are we going to get the Torah. And that's how the Sefer Chinuch is Masbir. That's how he explains the mitzvah. We're counting to inculcate in our own selves that sense of anticipation, that sense of, wow, when are we going to be there? When are we going to finally receive the Torah? However, of note, the Sefer Chinuch uses a very specific expression when he defines what it was like for the Jews then. He says as follows, V'inyu gadol hu lahem. For the Jews leaving Mitzrayim at the time, it was a great inyan. Getting the Torah in Har Sinai was a great inyan. Yosem and Acheres me avdus. It was greater to them than their leaving bondage. Meaning to say that as happy as they were, as joyous as they were by the fact that they had been slaves and now were freed, even greater to them was the fact that they were going to receive the Torah. Therefore, for them and for us to show in ourselves and to teach ourselves that great anticipation of the day, we count. But the line again that he says is that to the Jews then, and to us now as well, the sense of joy that they're about to receive the Torah was greater than the happiness that they experienced leaving bondage, leaving slavery. And if you think about that expression, as Sefer Chinuch says, I believe it becomes quite difficult to understand. Meaning, these people were literally slaves. Slavery in Mitzrayim was not just, you know, you worked a little bit, kind of worked long, hard hours. Slavery means that at any given time, any Mitzri could walk over to a Jew and say, boy, come here. And you were at his beck and call for a day, a week, a month, to do whatever he wanted. There was no concept of Jewish rights. There was no concept of Jewish property ownership. There was no concept of defending your own. You were owned by the Mitzrayim, but owned by the community called Mitzrayim. You had no rights whatsoever. And to say that the Jews were oppressed would be a tremendous understatement. Much of the work was of Avodas Perach, specifically to oppress, specifically to torture, so that the Jewish people should be low, they should be crushed. And to give you one illustration out of literally thousands, if you remember, Moshe Rabbeinu killed the Mitzri. Remember when Moshe Rabbeinu went out to see what was doing with his brethren, and he sees the Nogesh, he sees the Mitzri Nogesh hitting the Jewish person, and he says the Shema Mefurash and kills him. What was the lead up to that story? Rashi tells us what actually happened. The system of power was that there was one Mitzri Nogesh over 10 Jewish shoter, and each shoter, each Jewish officer was responsible for 10 Jews. So effectively, one Egyptian was the overseer of 100 Jews. Each morning, the single Egyptian Nogesh would wake up the shotrim. He'd wake up his 10 Jewish people under him. Each of those shotrim were responsible to wake up their 10 Jews, and that's how they made sure that all of the Jews went to work on time. It happens to be that one Nogesh set his eye upon a beautiful woman, the wife, the sister of Dothan. He set his eye upon this woman, and he decided that he wanted her. What did he do? He happened to be in the Nogesh. He went over to the shoter, this woman's husband, woke him extra early, said, "Come on, Jew, get up, get out." The Jewish person, being woken early, assumed it was time for him to wake up his 10 people. He went out, did his rounds. At that point, the Mitzri went back into the tent. She, the wife of the Jew, assumed that it was her husband who came back. He was ma'anes her. She was unaware. However, when the Jewish person went to wake up everybody and he found it was too early, it quickly became apparent that there was something amiss. He went back to his own tent, discovered what had happened. The Mitzri, who had done this, that next day understood that he had been found out. He realized that the Jew understood what he had done, and he was beating him to kill him. Not that he had to be concerned that the Jew would be malshim because there wasn't much recourse, but he didn't want the word out, and he was beating him to kill him. Moshe Rabbeinu saw this. Moshe Rabbeinu said, "That is such evil, that is such riches, you've lost your lease on life," and Moshe Rabbeinu killed him. But to understand that there were no rights, at any given time a Jew could be forced into any type of work, could not defend his wife, could not defend his children, he was oppressed and beaten, and then miraculously, and that's a tremendous understatement, miraculously were freed from bondage to absolute, total shlita, to being the most powerful, elite nation in the world. We go from being slaves to being freed, marched out with the Amei HaKavod. The joy that a person feels at that moment would be hard to describe. And we, some thousands of years later, try to feel that when we sit there at the Seder, we try to feel that sense of joy, that sense of freedom, of wow, our oppressors are drowned. What the Sefer HaChinuch is saying is that that joy was dwarfed. That joy was small compared to a much bigger joy. What was that much bigger joy? We're going to be mekabel the Torah. We're going to receive the Torah. And the question that I believe begs being asked on the Sefer HaChinuch is, how could that be? Meaning, we are all machshiv Torah. We all recognize the value, the importance of Torah. We recognize how important it is. But at the end of the day, if you're a slave and you're being beaten and you're free, that has got to be one of the greatest sense of joy and satisfaction imaginable. As great as Torah is, as important as it is, knowing that I'm going to receive the Torah in 49 days cannot compare to the joy of being oppressed and now being free. And yet the Sefer HaChinuch is telling us that not only was it a greater thing to them, they had more joy, more satisfaction. And the question is, what's pshat? And how do we understand the Sefer HaChinuch? And I'd like to see this evening, if we could address this. But to do this, I'd like to bring back an old memory. For those who are around, or if you listen to the tapes, Shmuz number 21 deals with the topic of choosing a career. And in that Shmuz, we dealt with the issue that the Chofetz Chaim explains that every human being has a natural inclination, a natural natiya for a type of work. There are some people who naturally gravitate towards working with their hands. There are some people who are just good with numbers. There are some people who have just a natural affinity to working with people. Says the Chofetz Chaim that each person was given a natural affinity, a natural inclination towards a type of malacha, type of work, and that's what you're supposed to be doing. The correct ishtadlis is not to say, gee, how can I make a lot of money? How could I support my family? The correct ishtadlis, says the Chofetz Chaim, is to ask yourself, what suits my nature? Just like the chatul, just like the cat hungers for the mouse, the robin hungers for the worm, so too Hashem put an instinctive drive within the human for a malacha, for a type of work that suits me. I'm naturally fitted for that, both intellectually, both by temperament, and that's the proper ishtadlus, to go out there and find the way to utilize those natural talents in the wisest possible way. That doesn't mean that if you have an atiya to bang nails, you have to be a carpenter. You may own a carpentry business, but the point being that there are certain natural inclinations. You're supposed to follow those inclinations in the wisest way possible. That's the way Hashem gave you the method to earn your panasa. Okay. Now, the reality is that every once in a while you find people who seem to just naturally have an atiyah, and sometimes you don't. And I believe that if you ask people what brings them real satisfaction in the workplace, I think there are two categories of things that bring them satisfaction. The first group, pretty self-explanatory. I knew a fellow who was a child psychologist in Rochester who would book 12 to 14 patients a day. Now, I don't know if you've ever tried to speak to another human being for 12 hours a day, but it's an exhausting, laborious work. He would book 12 to 14 patients a day, and he loved it. It was enjoyable. He was just so suited for it. He loved working with little children, helping them understand themselves, and he felt a tremendous sense of gratification, of satisfaction, helping a child reach their potential, and he loved his work. He had a natural affinity, a natural inclination, and derived a tremendous amount of satisfaction from the labor. I knew a fellow who was a surgeon. Since the time he was a little boy, all he dreamt about was being a doctor. And he once described to me what it was like to sit there in the operating room holding, not being involved in the operation, he was a medical student at the time, holding the sutures. He was holding, I guess, these forceps for the surgeon to do the particular operation, and he described how interesting, how fascinating, and as he stood there for 5 hours. 5 hours straight, he stood there holding the forceps, and I was like, what? But he loved it. It was exciting, exhilarating, it suited him, his temperament, his nature, that's a perfect fit. And oftentimes, you find people who derive tremendous satisfaction from their work because it's a natural fit for their personality. However, there is another type of satisfaction that you can get from your work that doesn't derive directly from the malacha. You could get outside hana, outside pleasure. Our oven broke Erev Yontif, and I called an appliance repairman living in Muncie who came, but a Hasidish fellow. And in his broken English, he explained to me which part was broken, immediately assessed the problem, immediately pulled the oven out, fixed it, and you could see the hana, the pleasure that he had, because of him, a Jewish woman would have her oven for Yontif. Believe me, he did not really enjoy changing fan motors. Opening and closing ovens was not a blast for him, but he derived a tremendous amount of pleasure from helping people, and that's what made the job fun. There's also another type of satisfaction you could derive in less of a holy way. I knew a fellow who would work somewhere around 12 hours a day, 6, often 7 days a week. He had made it pretty big. He was already being driven around with stretch limos, and clearly he was quite successful. And I could not help but ask him the question, if you're doing this well, why are you killing yourself? Why are you working so many hours, such hard, long days? And he said this line, he said, I guess I just like doing well. And what that means is money gave him a tremendous amount of satisfaction. He was in probably the most boring business you could ever imagine in your life. His business was putting washing machines in apartment buildings. I can think of very little else that would be about as mundane, as plain, as ordinary as that, but he loved it. Why? Because chink, 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 every machine that went in meant quarters, quarters meant dollars, dollars meant success, and the enjoyment to him had nothing to do with the malacha, had nothing to do with helping out other people. It had to do with a definition called money equals success, and he derived a tremendous amount of pleasure. He loves his work. There's no such thing as too long a work day. And when he's on vacation, he's dreaming about putting more machines in more buildings. Why do I share this with you? Because what this points to is the fact that there are different ways to derive satisfaction from the same activity. You could be either naturally suited for it, derive pleasure that way, or there could be outside factors, whether it be social, whether they be monetary. Every once in a while, all three converge. You can imagine Michael Jordan in his prime. And what that means is, since the time he's a little kid, all he's been dreaming about, all he's been doing is playing ball. It's something that comes so naturally to him, it's something that he doesn't have to think about, it's something that he's so attuned to. And not just that, socially he's given such honor, such accord. He's winning the NBA titles, and the money is beyond belief. He's a multi-millionaire. Could you imagine him saying to you the words, "Oh, what a chore, I got to go to work"? You would never hear those words. What do you mean work? It's a pleasure. It's wow. Playing ball is great. I live for it. I love it. He's got everything. The natural inclination, the social adulation and praise, and he's getting tons of money. Work is a blast. He loves it. What if I share with you, folks, the concept that Chazal tell us many, many times? Every Jew has a kinyan in Torah. And what that means is that every single Jew has within him an intense, real love for learning. There's a portion of Torah that's mine and mine alone. And there's a part of me that recognizes the extraordinary value of learning beyond anything in this world. You'll say to me, "Are you drunk?" I don't feel that. I mean, learning's a mitzvah. I know I should do it, and it may be even enjoyable, but it's not the most valuable thing in the world. It's not like, wow, I have such pleasure, and I can't wait to sit down to a Gemara, and when I'm sitting there, I'm just steiging, I'm growing, I'm so happy, I'm so fulfilled. However, my friends, I believe that every Jew intuitively has that sense, and I'll share with you what I mean. If you can imagine the following, you're walking on a very dark night, you're in the woods, and all of a sudden you take a wrong turn, and you're lost. Dead lost in the middle of the woods. There's not a spot of moon. It's pitch black. And all of a sudden you hear thunder clouds. And there's a lightning flash. And all of a sudden you realize you're dead lost in the woods. There's no way you're ever going to make it back. And it starts to rain and you start to panic. You start getting nervous, anxious. How am I going to ever make it back? And all of a sudden in the darkness of night, there's a lightning bolt that just illuminates the light with a thunderclap. And you see the entire horizon. That one lightning bolt lit up the entire forest, and you see your village. And you then make your path directly for that village. You're walking and you're walking, and then you lose your path again, and it's an hour later, and it's raining, and it's dark, and you don't know if you're going left or right. Another thunderbolt, a lightning flash, and you see it again. That, my friends, I believe is a very apt mushal for us in this world. We live in a huge, huge cloud of darkness. And it is very rare that we see truth. But there are moments, flashes of illumination. There's a lightning bolt every once in a while that goes off and we see things with a vastly different clarity. It's no longer murky, it's no longer dark, it's clear as day, and we see things with a totally different set of eyes. And those moments, those peak moments of inspiration, those flashes of illumination, we value things differently. And I believe every Jew at some point has one of those moments where they recognize a tremendous difference in the value system, where money is no longer really that significant. Honor, accord really doesn't matter, but there's a core reality. I recognize I was put on this planet for a purpose, and I recognize the extraordinary value of learning. I recognize how it changes me, how it molds me, and I also recognize that I have a chelik in it, I have an attachment to it. Sometimes that flash is instantaneous and it passes. Sometimes it illuminates the night as if it's day, but all of us at some point feel it. And what you have to learn to do is to take that moment of illumination when you see the world in a different way and chart your course based on that. When you see the night lit up and you see that's your village and you understand at that moment the value of learning, the value of a mitzvah, that's the moment you have to chart your course and use that as your tracking point in life. I believe that while we see it in moments of illumination, the Klai Yisrael, this point in their existence, saw it clear as day. You see, they had lived through months and months of Hashem showing that Hashem alone created and runs the world. It was Dam, Sradeya, Kinim, every one of the miracles was more the manifestation of Hashem's control over every facet of the world. And it became so clear that Hashem was not just a creator, but Hashem is present throughout. That if you remember, before the final Makkah, when the Jewish people took the Seh, they took the very God of the Mitzrim and tied it to the bedpost, And the Midrashim came and said, what are you doing? And the Jewish people said, we are preparing to slaughter this in 4 days. The Midrash tells us that they were chattering. The Egyptians' teeth were chattering because they couldn't say anything. Now you have to appreciate this. These were the slaves, the low slaves, who for years I bossed them around. Isaac, go there, do this, do that. And now all of a sudden he takes my God, my very Avodah Zarah, and he ties it to the bedpost and has the audacity to say he's going to slaughter it. And the Midrashim couldn't say a word. Why couldn't they say a word? Because it was so clear to even the simple Mitzri that Hashem was present. They didn't have the audacity, they didn't have the chutzpah. They couldn't move off of their spot to say anything because even they saw with absolute clarity that Hashem is right there. And that was before Kriyas Yamsuf. At Kriyas Yamsuf, every Jew saw that which the greatest Nevi'im didn't see. They saw Hashem Kaviyachol right there. And with that clarity of thought came a totally different understanding of life. They saw Hashem's presence. They understood the purpose of creation. They saw Olam Haba right there in front of them. And every Jew intuitively knew the extraordinary value of one word of Liman HaTorah. When they came out on the other side of the Yam, and they understood that they were now embarking on the ultimate trip, the journey to Kabbalah Satorah, they waited with such anxious anticipation because they got it. It wasn't a light in the night. There wasn't a bolt of lightning that lit up the darkness. They saw with absolute clarity the extraordinary value of learning. They understood their purpose in creation. They understood how every word changes them. And they pined away for that moment. They waited, when will I be there? When will I receive the Torah? Says the Sefer HaChinuch, they had greater pleasure, greater anticipation waiting for that moment than they had knowing that they were freed. And I believe what this demonstrates is when a human being gets it, it changes their whole existence. They become a very, very different sort of person, and they understand things in a very different way. But Aaron Cutler explains the reason why we don't learn as much as we should is twofold. Number one, we're not machshiv Torah. We don't understand the extraordinary value of Torah. And number two, we're lacking in avas Torah. We don't love learning. And both of these really are subject to the same mistake. You see, if we were to recognize the extraordinary value, automatically everything would change. Just this past week, a fellow was showing me a beautiful ksav. He showed me a mezuzah that he was selling for $200, and I have to admit, it was beautiful. Now, you could easily buy a kosher mezuzah for $85, maybe $65, but this was a $200 mezuzah, and it was gorgeous. Now, whether it's appropriate to spend $200 or not is dependent much on your financial situation. However, if you are in that bracket where you could afford it, I say it's a very wise investment to spend that extra amount of money, because zekeli vanveu, you're buying a better mitzvah. If you spend more for the better model car, you had better spend more for the better mitzvah. It's a much wiser investment. You've bought yourself a much better kinyan. You could also spend literally thousands of dollars for a better pair of tefillin. Because, you know, there are tefillin, and there are tefillin. There are parshios, and there are parshios. And you should know something else. You could easily spend $50,000 to buy yourself a Sefer Torah. Now, the Sefer Chinuch explains that even though in the Torah there is a mitzvah for every Jew to own a Sefer Torah, he explains in our day that probably means owning Svarim. However, owning a Sefer Torah is a very fine aspiration that every Jew should have. And again, if you're in the financial situation that you could drop 50 grand, it is a wise recommendation. You buy yourself a beautiful Sefer Torah, you put it in an aron in your house, and you know that you've made a very wise investment. But my friends, let's understand what we're talking. $200, thousands of dollars, $50,000, you see many mitzvahs cost an awful lot of money, and if they don't cost resources in the sense of financial resources, they cost in terms of time, in terms of energy. If you've ever done a real chesed for another Jew, you understand it takes an awful lot of your time, energy, and effort. What if I were to tell you that there is a mitzvah that you could accomplish like that? And when I say like that, I mean like that. It is easy as pie. as fast as anything, and it's golden, as valuable as any other mitzvah, arguably more valuable. In fact, it's a mission that tells us that it is the most valuable mitzvah. And if you want to know what I'm talking about, I'll give you one simple mushel. I remember reading about grape harvest in the olden days. The grapes typically become ripened in a very short period of time. You have about 2 weeks to harvest the grapes. From the time they become ripe until they become effectively rotten or drop off the vines is a very short time period. And because grapes are very delicate, what that means is throughout the millennium, when you had to harvest the grapes, you need an entire team of people. You had but a few short weeks. You had a tremendous amount of vines that you had to, by hand, take the grapes gently off of. Therefore, you needed many, many people. You needed a whole crew to be intensely working from early morning until late at night, until they invented the grape harvester. The grape harvester can do that which took an entire team of men 2 weeks in 1 hour. And you'll see this combine. They'll bring it through the grapevines and gently picking up the clusters, gently transferring it down, gently putting it where it belongs, going through an entire field of grapes in but an hour. That which took a team of men literally weeks can now be done in but a short amount of time. And then you understand exactly what the Mishnah is saying. The single mitzvah that is golden, that is more valuable than any other mitzvah, is Limud Torah. But there is a machine called the mouth. And the mouth is a superpower harvester that just rattles out word after word after word, which each one is a separate mitzvah asay. Each word of Limud Torah is a mitzvah asay. The Dibarta Bom means each word is a separate mitzvah. Each word is an additional mitzvah, equivalent to a mezuzah, equivalent to a pair of tefillin, equal to a sefer Torah. But it's word after word after word after word, 200 a minute, thousands an hour. In a day you can rack up tens of thousands. It's beyond belief. And the only reason that we're not so excited to sit down to a blot Gemara, the only reason we're not supercharged, when can I get out of work so I can sit down to finally open that Mishnayos, is because we're spaced out. We're living in a world of darkness. We're living in a world of illusion. We don't get it. Whatever, it's learning. Yeah, I get some mitzvah, I should. Yeah, Tafayomi, yeah, Mishnayos, I know. Mishnayos Mikra, yeah, I should. I'm going to try, I'm really going to try. If we would wake up and understand the extraordinary value, each word is a diamond, each word is a golden coin, and I have this human harvester rattling out word after word after word after word, we'd be so excited, we'd be so invigorated, we'd be alive with a drive. There would be no greater simcha in our life than the opportunity. When could I stop these mundane things I'm doing so I could finally sit down to learn? And if we don't understand it, the Klai Yisrael then did. When they came out on the other side of the Yam, everything was clear. They understood why Hashem created them. They understood what they were doing here. And they understood that 49 days from now was the moment of creation, the moment of the purpose of creation. They were going to be Mekabel Torah. There was nothing that was more valuable, nothing that brought them more joy. And we can hook into that. The mitzvah Siris HaOmer says, the Sefer Chinuch, is us teaching ourselves that lesson. Each day that we count is to train ourselves, this is the most valuable mitzvah. I can acquire it. I can attain it. Kabbalah Satorah is coming. At 43, I got just a few days left, just a couple of days left. Let me count. Let me get ready. Let me get excited. And the more a person does that, and the more a person appreciates the value of Torah, the more they love learning, the more they understand. Of course, naturally, I have an affinity. I have a chelik in Torah. I'm a Jew. My neshama shines. For one person, it may be much more svara. Another person, much more yediyas. One person's into bekiyas. Another person's into halacha. There are different affinities, different natural inclinations. But every Jew has a chelik. Every Jew has a natural desire. And if you want to study Michael Jordan at the height of his career, when every day is, wow, the crowds are going wild, I'm making millions of dollars and I'm doing what I'm loving, that's what a Jew should be experiencing when he sits down to learn. And if we don't, it's because we're spaced out. The choshech hachomrius, the darkness of physicality, just blinds us, stops us from seeing, and doesn't allow us to experience that which we intuitively know is true. Every once in a while you get it. Maybe it's on a Shavuos. Maybe it's late at night when you're a bit punch drunk and something comes over you and you get it. And you understand that the next time I open my mouth and I ask a question, I say a svara, I talk in learning, I'm being mekayim, one mitzvah, 10 mitzvahs, maybe 100 mitzvahs, and you get it. And it's like a lightning bolt that lights up the darkness and you, wow, I get it. When you get it, you have to then chart your course. You have to remember that feeling, you have to remember that clarity, because you're going to forget it again. Being a human means you get excited and you forget, you get exhilarated and you come down. But if you see something in that moment, if there's a lightning flash and you see the village, and you see a different clarity of understanding, you can then use that to chart your course by. You can remember that, and you could use that to set the rest of your days, the rest of your weeks, and you could use that to guide you through life. I think there is a tremendous lesson to be learned from the Sefer HaChinuch. The Klai Yisrael experienced torture upon torture, the most inhumane, barbaric existence, and you have to believe that when they were freed from that, there was a simcha, there was a joy that was unbelievable. But the Sefer HaChinuch is telling us that there was a joy that was even superior to that. Knowing that they were going to be mekabel the Torah was even greater joy in their heart and brought them a greater sense of satisfaction. And the reason is because they got it. Living through Dam, Svadeya, Kinim, living through Kriyas Yamsuf means they saw Hashem, just like the Mitzri didn't dare say a word when his Avodah Zarah was tied to the bedpost, because he saw Hashem. The Jews so much more so saw Hashem, they understood the reason for creation, they understood the value of one mitzvah, they understood that their B'nai Olam Haba, their eternity, is based on their actions, and with that they had this tremendous love for learning, tremendous value for Torah, and with that it brought them a sense of joy that was uncomparable. Every Jew has this, it's just a question of how much you bring it out, how much you feel it, how much you work on it, and how much you experience it. I'd like to close with a mashal that I'm borrowing from the Chofetz Chaim. I want you to imagine the following. I want you to imagine that you're called to your grandfather's deathbed. And when you're walking the few blocks to your grandfather's house, you sort of review things. Your grandfather's a patriarch of the family. He's done very well in many ways. He's also financially successful. And you remember all of the rumors how before the war, when grandpa was in Europe, he was a wealthy, wealthy man, phenomenally wealthy. Couldn't bring anything with him, but he started over a fresh year and he did well for himself. And as you come in, you realize you're going to bid your grandfather goodbye. And he says to you as follows, come here. I want you to listen to me very carefully. I know you heard the rumors, but you didn't hear a tenth of the rumors. We were so wealthy in Europe before the war. It was generation after generation. Our family owned everything. We did not own real estate, we owned cities. We didn't own businesses, we owned industries. We owned forests, we owned the railroads. Our wealth was unimaginable. As you know, in 1933, Hitler came to power. And I knew what was going to happen. The next 5 years, I spent liquidating everything. I sold the businesses, I sold the real estate, I sold everything I could possibly sell. And I took into my possession the most liquid commodity I could. I picked up diamonds. And I filled up 10 canisters with diamonds. In 1938, I went out to the mountain. I went alone. And I dug 10 spots, 100 yards apart. And I dug these spots and I put these canisters of diamonds. Each one's a king's ransom. I buried them. And I swore that I would never come back. And when I came to these shores, I also promised myself that none of my children, none of my grandchildren would ever go back to that cursed country. But now I recognize it wasn't just my wealth, it was my parents, my grandparents' wealth as well. It wouldn't be right to leave in the ground. Here's the map, here's the spot, I want you to dig it up. And with that, your grandfather leaves the world. After the Shiva, after the whole thing is done, first thing you do is you get on a plane, you follow that lead, and you find that mountain, and you start digging. And I guarantee if the first spot you dig does not turn up a canister of diamonds, you dig again and you dig again and you look back at that map and you look back at the map and you dig and you dig and you dig and you dig until you find the first canister. And when you find that first canister and you crack open the lid and you see the unbelievable value, diamonds upon diamonds upon diamonds pouring out into your hands, magnificent, flawless diamonds. And you say to yourself, there are nine more. This is not the only canister. There's nine more of these. You start digging and digging with a feverish, burning fire within you, and nothing stops you. That, my friends, I believe is a very apt mushal to if we could ever get it. It doesn't really take digging in the dirt to gain in Torah study. But there are times when it's difficult. There are times when there are many obstacles, whether it be busyness, whether it be distractions, whether it be all the things in life, and there are times when it takes a push, there are times when it takes a commitment, but if we would ever get it, it's diamonds and diamonds and diamonds, canisters of diamonds, and every Jew at one point has opened one of those canisters. At one point you felt that sweet taste of learning, you really understood what it was about. Now you have to find the rest of your chelik, not someone else's chelik, not someone else's portion, the rest of your portion, but you got to get it. You have to understand the value, you have to understand it's waiting for you, and then you have to dig and you have to be ready to go forward. When a person gets it, when a person understands it, they live a very different life. May Hashem grant us the wisdom, the understanding, allow us in this Kabbalah Torah to put this into practice.